and the Angels Were Silent by Max Lucado. Chapter 27. I reckons I will always remember that walk. In the same way, the Son of Man did not come to be served. He came to serve others and to give his life as a ransom for many people. Matthew 20:28. So what should I do with Jesus? Pilate asked it first, but we've all asked it since. It's a fair question, a necessary question. What do you do with such a man? He called himself God, but wore the clothes of a man. He called himself the Messiah, but never marshaled an army. He was regarded as king, but his only crown was of thorns. People revered him as regal, yet his only robe was stitched with mockery. Small wonder Pilate was puzzled. How do you explain such a man? One way is to take a walk. His walk. His final walk. And that is what we have done. We have followed his steps and stood in his shadow. From Jericho to Jerusalem. From the temple to the garden. From the garden to the trial. From Pilate's palace to Golgotha's cross. We have watched him walk, angrily into the temple, wearily into Gethsemane, painfully up the Via Dolorosa, and powerfully out of the vacated tomb. Hopefully, as you witnessed his walk, you have reflected on your own. For all of us have our own walk to Jerusalem, our own path through hollow religion, our own journey down the narrow path of rejection. And each of us, like Pilate, must cast a verdict on Jesus. Pilate heard the voice of the people and left Jesus to walk the road alone. Will we? May I conclude with the stories of three walks, three journeys? The stories of three slaves and the paths they took to freedom. Mary Barber could tell you about slavery firsthand. She remembered the marsh and the marster. She could describe the plantation, the stick and mud slave house with the bunks, the long nights, hot days, hard whips, isolation. Mary Barber could tell you about it. Mary Barber was a slave. But she'd rather tell you about freedom, and that is what she did. In 1935, a worker with the Federal Writers Project knocked on her door in Raleigh, North Carolina. The Federal Writers Project was a government-sponsored effort to record the memories of ex-slaves. Over 2,000 were interviewed. These, the final voices to speak for the 246 years of bondage in America, did so with earthy eloquence. They told how they were not allowed to read or write, nor purchase or sell merchandise. They couldn't go to church unless invited. Whippings were common. Hard life was a fact of life. And when freedom came, they weren't ready. They wandered roads looking for work. They were victimized by opportunists. Many ended up back at the same plantation. But of all the memories, the most vivid and the one most often shared was the hour of freedom. The night the Yanks came. The day the marster told them they could leave. The morning they went up to the big house and found it empty. And of the stories of liberation, none were so specific as Mary Barber's. She was 10 years of age the night her father awoke her and led her to the wagon which would carry them to freedom. Before you read her words, picture her seated on the porch in Raleigh. It's 1935. Mary Barber is over 80 years old. She rocks as she thinks, her tiny body swallowed up by the large chair. Her frail fingers tremble as she rubs her nose. Old but eager eyes stare out as if she is gazing into a land far on the horizon. You lean back against the pole and listen to her story. One of the first things that I remembers was my pappy waking me up in the middle of the night, dressing me in the dark, all the time telling me to keep quiet. One of the twins hollered some, and Pappy put his hand over its mouth to keep it quiet. After we was dressed, we went outside and peeped around for a minute. Then he comed back in and got us. We snook out of the house and along the woods path, Pappy toting one of the twins and holding me by the hand, and Mammy carrying the other two. I reckons I will always remember that walk, with the bushes slapping my legs, the wind sighing in the trees, and the hoot owls and the whippoorwills hollering at each other from the big trees. I was half asleep and scared stiff. But in a little while, we passed the plum thicket, and there am the mules and the wagon. And there am the quilt in the bottom of the wagon, and on this they lays we young'uns. And Pappy and Mammy gets on the board across the front and drives off down the road. I was sleepy, but I was scared too. So as we rides along, I listens to Pappy and Mammy talk. Pappy was telling Mammy about the Yankees coming to their plantation, burning the corn cribs, the smokehouses, and destroying everything. He says right low that they done took Marster Jordan to the riprap's down nigh Norfolk, and that he stole the mules on the wagon and escaped. Glimmerings of deliverance. Lingerings of the liberation. 6 decades later, the wind still sighs in the trees, and the whippoorwills and hoot owls still holler at each other in Mary Barber's memory. The walk to freedom is never forgotten. The path taken from slavery to liberation is always vivid. It's more than a road, it's a release. The shackles are opened, and perhaps for the first time, freedom dawns. I reckons I will always remember that walk. Do you remember yours? Where were you the night the door was opened? Do you remember the touch of the Father? Who walked with you the day you were set free? Can you still see the scene? Can you feel the road beneath your feet? I hope so. I hope that permanently planted in your soul is the moment the Father stirred you in the darkness and led you down the path. It's a memory like no other. For when he sets you free, you are free indeed. Ex-slaves describe well the hour of deliverance. Can I tell you mine? A Bible class in a small West Texas town. I don't know what was more remarkable, that a teacher was trying to teach the book of Romans to a group of 10-year-olds, or that I remember what he said. The classroom was mid-sized, one of a dozen or so in a small church. My desk had carving on it and gum under it. 20 or so others were in the room, though only 4 or 5 were taken. We all sat in the back, too sophisticated to appear interested. Starched jeans, high-topped tennis shoes. It was summer, and the slow-setting sun cast the window in gold. The teacher was an earnest man. I can still see his flat top, his belly bulging from beneath his coat that he doesn't even try to button. His tie stops midway down his chest. He has a black mole on his forehead, a soft voice, and a kind smile. Though he is hopelessly out of touch with the kids of 1965, he doesn't know it. His notes are stacked on a podium underneath a heavy black Bible. His back is turned to us, and his jacket goes up and down his belt line as he writes on the board. He speaks with genuine passion. He is not a dramatic man, but tonight he is fervent. God only knows why I heard him that night. His text was Romans chapter 6. The blackboard was littered with long words and diagrams. Somewhere in the process of describing how Jesus went into the tomb and came back out, it happened. The jewel of grace was lifted and turned so I could see it from a new angle, and it stole my breath. I didn't see a moral code. I didn't see a church. I didn't see 10 commandments or hellish demons. I saw what another 10-year-old, Mary Barber, saw. I saw my Father enter my dark night, awaken me from my slumber, and gently guide me, no, carry me, to freedom. I reckons I will always remember that walk. I said nothing to my teacher. I said nothing to my friends. I'm not sure I even said anything to God. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. And for all I didn't know, There was one fact of which I was absolutely sure. I wanted to be with him. I told my father that I was ready to give my life to God. He thought I was too young to make the decision. He asked what I knew. I told him Jesus was in heaven and I wanted to be with him. And for my dad, that was enough. To this day, I wonder if my love has ever been as pure as it was that first hour. I long for the certainty of my adorning faith. Had you told me that Jesus was in hell, I would have agreed to go. Public confession and baptism came as naturally for me as climbing into the wagon did for Mary Barber. You see, when your father comes to deliver you from bondage, you don't ask questions. You obey instructions. You take his hand. You walk the path. You leave bondage behind, and you never, never forget. Mary Barber didn't. I haven't. And Tigney didn't. Tigney belonged to the Wallamo tribe in interior Ethiopia. In the years preceding World War II, missionaries carried the message of Christ to this Satan-worshipping tribe. One of the early converts was Tigney. Raymond Davis was the missionary who knew him and freed him. Tigney was a slave. His decision to follow Jesus displeased his master, who refused to allow Tigney to attend Bible studies or worship. He frequently beat and humiliated Tigney for his faith. But it was a price this young Christian was willing to pay. There was another price, however, he could not afford. He couldn't purchase his freedom. For only $12, his master would release him. But for this slave who'd never known a salary, it might as well have been a million. When the missionaries learned that his freedom could be purchased, they talked it over, pooled some money, and bought his freedom. Tigney was now free, both spiritually and physically. He never outlived his gratitude to the men who had redeemed him. Soon after his day of liberty, the missionaries were expelled from Ethiopia. 24 years passed before Raymond Davis returned to Wallamo. During this quarter of a century, Tigney remained a vivid testimony to the power of freedom. He longed to see Davis again. When he heard that his friend was coming, he went to the mission station several days in a row to wait. Dates on the calendar or time on the clock had no significance for Tigney, so he came daily to search for Davis. Finally, Davis arrived, riding in a car driven by a fellow missionary. When Tigney saw the vehicle come around the corner, he ran to the window and took Davis's hand and began to kiss it again and again. The driver slowed the car so Tigney could run beside it. As he ran, he yelled to his friends, "Behold, behold, one of those who redeem me has returned." Finally, the car stopped. Davis got out and Tigney dropped to his knees, put his arms around his friend's legs, and began to kiss his dusty shoes. Davis reached down to bring him to full height, and they stood with their arms around each other and wept. Three ex-slaves, one freed from man, one freed from sin, and one freed from both. Three walks, one destiny, freedom. It's a walk they will never forget. I reckon I will always remember that walk. I pray you never forget your walk or his, Jesus' final walk from Jericho to Jerusalem. For it was this walk that promised you freedom. His final walk through the temple of Jerusalem. For it was on this walk that he denounced hollow religion. His final walk to the Mount of Olives, for it was there he promised to return and take you home. And his final walk from Pilate's palace to Golgotha's cross, bare bloody feet struggling up a stony, narrow path. But just as vivid as the pain of the beam against his raw back is his vision of you and him walking together. He could see the hour he would come into your life, into your dark cabin to stir you out of your sleep and guide you to freedom. But the walk isn't over. The journey isn't complete. There is one more walk that must be made. "I will come back," he promised. And to prove it, he ripped into the temple curtain and split open the doors of death. He will come back. He, like the missionary, will come back for his followers, and we, like Tigny, won't be able to control our joy. The one who has redeemed us has returned, we will cry, and the journey will end, and we will take our seats at his feast forever. See you at the table.